Gilman continues reading The Betrayal by Helen Dunmore. It was abridged by Sally Marmion, and the producer was Di Spears.
The Comedy Club on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
I'm John Holmes, and recently I was able to chat to my my comedy compatriot, if you will, from BBC Radio 4 and 4 Extras, The Now Show. Obviously, I could chat to him anytime I like because I see him every time we record The Now Show. But, you know, we just sort of hung out and thought we'd discuss some comedy for you. Steve Punt. It feels quite odd because they said sort of, John, you'll be interviewing Steve Punt next week, and I was like, what sort of the mate from The Now Show then? That's is that an interview or is that just a conversation?
There's a slightly incestuous quality about
it's
this
slightly
interview.
Weird, isn't it? Yeah,
but then, you know, you are a proper interviewer. You do a lot of this interviewing lot.
I do, it's true. And some are better than others. It has to be. Let's see which one this falls into.
Yeah,
some are awkward, you know. Arnold Schwarzenegger, didn't like him. Didn't like him at all. No.
Was he offish?
He was offish. Yes, he was very offish. When I got into the room to interview him, because it wasn't like this where, you know, you kindly turn up into a radio studio.
Yeah.
You have to go to a hotel for that.
Do you? Is he surrounded by large minders as well, pointing at their watches?
Flunkies. Exactly that. And he didn't even look up until the tape was rolling, because he was reading a coffee table book that he'd found in the wherever we were. Was it the Ritz or somewhere, I think? And he didn't even look. He wouldn't even acknowledge that I was there.
I will be with you in a minute.
I'd be happy with that, if I'm honest.
I once did a little documentary feature for Radio 4, which involved... It was about the dubbing industry.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really interesting, because in Britain and in America, we're basically the only countries in the world who are not used to watching dub TV. And most countries in the rest of Europe, they watch loads of... They're entirely used to watching stuff that's dubbed.
Yeah.
And I met the French Arnold Schwarzenegger. And
what sort of accent's that?
He doesn't look anything like him at all. And
does he attempt to sound like him in any way?
That's the weird thing. Have you ever seen The Simpsons abroad?
No.
Ever switched on telly in France? You see The Simpsons, and of course they don't sound like The Simpsons, and it's a very strange thing. But it's a huge culture in Europe, and the French Arnold Schwarzenegger told me that. That in Germany, Arnold Schwarzenegger asked to dub himself. He asked to dub the Terminator himself because obviously he speaks German.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, he speaks Austrian German, which, if you're a German, sounds like deep Somerset or something. It's regarded as a really rural accent. So you would have had the Terminator effectively going, "Oh, you'll be back."
Oh, you want your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle.
Exactly. Yeah. So he was given the ignominy of being told that he couldn't dub his own voice.
Oh, that's good, isn't it?
So I'm guessing maybe that he's still a bit narked about that, and that's why
why he's cross with everybody.
He's just sitting there reading a coffee table book.
I had a good anecdote as well. I told him that a friend of mine went for a job interview at Madame Tussauds years ago, right, in robotics, in their like moving animatronic.
Wow.
Yeah. He didn't get the job, but what he did get was, for some, they were throwing away the head, an old head of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he asked for it and they gave it to him. And he got on the central line, the circle line, it was the circle line in London, on the tube with the head of Arnold Schwarzenegger, right, but left it on the tube. So somewhere this head
as
of Arnold
you would,
was going round and round the circle line. And I told Arnold this, thinking he'll like that. That's a good anecdote. He just stared at his coffee table book and didn't even. And I was going, "So, you know, your head, Arnie." And he was like,
You would think if someone was to tell you that a replica of your head was circling the London Underground, do you know what would be brilliant as well? Would be if the head had a little red light in one of the eyes.
Yeah.
And just as it reaches Tower Hill, the light comes on.
The Comedy Club on BBC Radio 4 Extra. Sunday to Friday nights from 10.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now we come to the end of Letters to Monica by Philip Larkin. The poet looks back at his life leading up to his 50th birthday. Despite the success of the Whitsun weddings, wonders if he's achieved all that he set out to. The reader is Hugh Bonneville.
October 18th, 1958, Hull. Dearest Bun, I have spent nearly all evening trying to finish this poem. I've never known anything resist me so. Not even church going, which I find I abandoned once. It's called The Whitson Weddings, unless I can think of anything better. Verses 7 and 8 have taken since about the beginning of August. I wish I felt that such intransigence was a good sign, but I don't. The Whitson Weddings. That Whitson, I was late getting away. Not till about 1:20 on the sunlit Saturday did my three-quarters empty train pull out. All windows down, all cushions hot, all sense of being in a hurry gone. We ran behind the backs of houses, crossed a street of blinding windscreens, smelt the fish dock. Thence the river's level, drifting breadth began, where sky and Lincolnshire and water meet. All afternoon, through the tall heat that slept for miles inland, a slow and stopping curve southwards we kept. Wide farms went by, short-shadowed cattle, and canals with floatings of industrial froth. A hothouse flashed uniquely, hedges dipped and rose, and now and then a smell of grass displaced the reek of buttoned carriage cloth, until the next town, new and nondescript, approached with acres of dismantled cars. At first, I didn't notice what a noise the weddings made.
12th of August, 1962, Loughborough. Dearest Bun, home is a sad place. I find so much from the last 20 years and before. Your letters, telegrams about my school results, letters about a girl in winter. I feel I've done nothing with that fat fillet steak part of life, 20 to 40, and now it's gone. And I haven't done anything with it because I'm too spiritless and cowardly and talentless. People live a lifetime a year compared with me. 29th of September, Hull. I wish you could see yourself in the centre of my mantelpiece, standing by the hydrangeas dressed for Bunny United, in your delinquent stockings and shoes, a handbag hanging from your hand. It has come up quite nicely. You look like a poster for an X film, but basically innocent all the same. Of course, I am grateful for your openness and assurances about Bill. It gives me a queer, disagreeable feeling to think of you with someone else. I don't know how I should feel if, instead of Bill, it was a 40-year-old professor with a sports car. Well, I do know how I should feel. The question is how strongly I should feel it. I am not, for the record, feeling attracted by Maeve again. 23rd of October. Dearest Rabbit, I am home in the dark, clutching my bottle of gin and my lemon. After drink, supper, and a bemused, gassed doze, I sit up and try to improve, or make less bad, my two current poems, Toads Revisited and Sunny Prestatin, about the poster we saw at Tweedmouth. I did go out on Sunday. The cottage gardens are all purple and red and gold, and the hedges full of hips and haws and elderberries, and now and again a pale pink wild rose. I stopped at Warne and poked about in the churchyard, turning up chestnuts in the grass. When I was there, a woman called that if I was going into the church, would I be careful to shut the door, as the heating was on. I was glad I did, because it was all decorated for Harvest Home. Really very thrilling and funny. The lines of cabbages and cauliflowers, piles of tomatoes in little stone niches, a box of dates on the harmonium, celery up the aisle. I don't think I've seen a church so decorated for years, and the shock of it was tremendous. Of course, I thought of you, although rabbits would be unlikely to take part in such a ceremony, at least not in the way intended. I left them a pound and shut the door carefully. All I harvest is money, but they were welcome to some of that. June 13th, 1963. It's duller today and cooler. A a kind of fine rain mist blowing. For once this has been a fairly empty week, but I haven't felt any inclination to write poetry. As a matter of fact, I sent off my collection to Faber's on Tuesday. Provisionally called The Whitson Weddings, it comprised 33 poems. Some are very thin. In fact, I might knock out two even now. It's a poor harvest for 9 years. In fact, I think it's definitely worse than The Less Deceived. Too many depend on mere sentiment. It's all very depressing. But then, what isn't? 3rd of March, 1964. Dearest, had a good journey back. Two people asked me to autograph The Whitson Weddings in the train. The Ringo Starr of contemporary verse. I get my first driving license and my first car in it 6 months after I took my first lesson, creeping petrified round the park in low gear. Now I creep petrified along the roads in no gear at all. 19th of May. The TV men making the monitor film are after the Arundel tomb in Chichester. I hope to God it's there and I didn't dream it. They want to know if it's freestanding or against a wall. I hope all my descriptions are accurate. Jointed armour, stiffened pleat, little dogs. I'm quite likely to have invented them. Do you remember it? I expect you do. Total recall. 28th of December. Have now recovered the post and find even Vernon Watkins saw monitor. He adds that he shut his eyes while the poems were being read. This is so typical of him. Also, Patrick Garland, the BBC producer, saying it has been judged a great success and lots of people have bought copies of The Whitson Weddings in consequence. This is a revelation to me of the power of television. It's like The Guardian compared with The Telegraph. 8th of October, 1966. Dearest, I was much relieved to get your letter this morning and to know you felt less distressed. I slept very badly last night thinking about it all. I don't take any credit for this, for really my thoughts were mostly selfish. There isn't any need to make my situation any better sounding than it is. A self-centred person conducting an affair containing almost no responsibilities with one girl, getting mixed up with another, heedless of the feelings of either. The incident in July, I mentioned, wasn't really epoch-making. Maeve suddenly got very cross at my evident preoccupation with you and said she was going to clear out for 6 months, and if I decided I wanted her, I could see if she was still available, and in the meantime she would do what she liked and so on. As far as I can see, she does that anyway. I didn't really respond to this, and she found the separation so upsetting that she called it off. But it has left its mark. You may wonder why I don't end it, in my own interest as well as yours. Partly cowardice, I dread the scene. Partly kindness. If I've encouraged her to depend on me, it seems cruel to turn her away. I only hope it can be done friendlily, because we do have to have a lot to do with each other anyway. Never have the gods of the copybook headings been better exemplified. Don't touch the female staff. I don't expect all this seems particularly endearing to you. I say it because I never seem to say anything, and I sometimes think if you knew more, you'd worry less. Darling, this seems far from the nice letter you ask for. I am at home with you, and think you are delightful and irreplaceable. I hate it when you go, for the dreary failure and selfishness on my part it seems to symbolise. It's my own unwillingness to give myself to anyone else that's at fault, like promising to stand on one leg for the rest of one's life. And yet I never think I am doing anything but ruin your life and mine. I suppose one shouldn't be writing letters like this at 44. One ought to have got it all sorted out 20 years ago. 3rd of June, 1967. I celebrated Thomas Hardy's birthday by finishing my 16-year-old's poem about spring. It runs, "The trees are coming into leaf, like something almost being said. The recent buds relax and spread. Their greenness is a kind of grief. The faint reclothing of mid-air that thickens into restless towers creates a different world from ours up to the edge of winter. There, a summer is a separate thing that makes no reference to the past and may not even be the last and mocks our lack of blossoming. First verse all right, the rest crap, especially the last line. What do you think of it?
9th of August, 1972. Dearest, well, I have had some good cards, heard from the choir kittens and the Warrens. Their number seems to be growing. There is talk of parsnip wine now. Letters or notes from BJ, Brett, welcome to the over-50s club, mother, the aunt, greetings telegrams from Charles and a local mad bint, cards from the usual.
Well, Philip Larkin is 50, and we've again invited a group of poets to choose and read their favourite from among his poems. And it's appropriate, I think, that the first one...
Later.
...be the poet still...
Mad with rage with the effing BBC. Getting the time wrong in this area for Larkin at 50. People rang me up asking what the hell. Shall write to the Governor-General, someone called Curran. Anyway, Bob's reading quite pleased me. Ted's too, funnily enough. Benjamin did his best. I was so glad he did Toad's Revisited, a nice poem, I think. Rather a lot of old friends, I thought. Enough to annoy non-friends. Well, darling, I wish you'd been here. I hope you heard it. You can hear it again when you're here, and your lovely records, which will really be the most lasting thing of today. Except being 50. Oh, yeah, booger. Of course I am glad. Do say... Do. Love. P.
After 1972, the letters are mainly shorter and much less frequent. Larkin's mother went in January that year into a hospital in Leicester, then into a nursing home nearby. This meant that Larkin was visiting his mother much more often, and therefore seeing Monica in Leicester more frequently. In October 1982, Monica fell downstairs in her Haydon Bridge cottage, went into Hexham Hospital, and then convalesced with Larkin. But then, at Easter 1983, she was badly stricken with shingles. When she was released from hospital, Larkin offered her shelter and care in his house in Newland Park, Hull. Larkin looked after Monica until his death in December 1985, 25 years ago.
Episode 5 of Letters to Monica was concluded by Anthony Thwaite, a close friend of Philip Larkin and the editor of the Letters Collection. The reader was Hugh Bonneville, the abridger is Miranda Davis, and the producer, Lucy Collingwood. On Monday, Terence Blacker celebrates Willie Donaldson's outrageous life, the creator of the Henry Root letters, and one of the best titles ever, You Cannot Live As I Have Lived and Not End Up Like This.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Susan Ray, and we're well into the epic tale of Alexander, starring Michael Maloney as the Greek king of Macedon, part 4 today. And tonight, a new series of the world's best-loved epistolary equine comedy romance, as we reveal more of the recently discovered passionate letters between the Duke of Wellington's horse, Copenhagen, played by Daniel Rigby, and Napoleon's steed, Marengo, played by Stephen Fry. War Horses of Letters, at 10 in the Comedy Club. So, part 4 of Alexander, in which the warrior becomes King of Macedonia and sets out to conquer the world.
Alexander, a 6-part serial on the life of Alexander the Great by David Wade. With Michael Maloney as Alexander, Alex Jennings as Hephaestion, Barry Foster as the spirit of Achilles, Simon Ward as the spirit of Patroclus, Geraldine James as Queen Olympias, and Charles Kay as Darius. Alexander, Part 4, The Road to Gordium. E.G., soon after sunrise on a summer's day in the year 336 B.C., King Philip of Macedon is about to enter the great amphitheatre when...
The sword has found its mark.
Unknowing, in the theatre sits the wedding party. Alexander's sister, newly married to her uncle, surrounded by the guests. All waiting for their host, King Philip, to make his entrance.
But he will never come. He stands before the gate of the auditorium. Pausanias, his bodyguard turned killer, close in front of him. On Philip's face, an expression of complete surprise.
For this is not how he expected Delphian Apollo's prophecy to be accomplished.